studying on our Sunday evenings one of the most romantic books in the whole Bible. There are some very romantic little stories are scattered throughout. One of my most favourites is when Jacob works for 7 years for Rachel, and it seems like only a day for her. Or the story of David and Abigail, that's quite romantic, isn't it? But I think the story of Ruth is the most romantic story that we find in the Bible. And we're coming to one of the most romantic chapters, which is chapter 3. And you'll find it, we're going to read in a moment, at Ruth chapter 3, on page 269 of the blue Bible you were given as you came in, which we'll read in just a moment. But before we do, let's just think about how the world sees the whole issue of romance and love. People sing about love all the time, don't they? I mean, that's must be the most common theme for songs. But as I was looking through my rather small CD collection, I realised that it contains a lot of music by some very angry and upset women. I don't know if names like Alanis Morissette or Annie Lennox or Sinead O'Connor mean anything to you. Anybody know those names? No. I see a few heads nodding. They sing a lot about love, but most of the time they sing about how love goes wrong and how it leaves you hurt and screwed up and full of angst and anger. Yet, in spite of that, in the middle of all their angry songs, you nearly always find a song that tells the other side of the story. "Oh, I'll show you something good," sings Annie Lennox. "If you open your heart, you can make a new start. When your crumbling world falls apart, the miracle of love will take away your pain when the miracle of love comes your way again." And then Alanis Morissette, even more miraculously, has something good to say about love too. "You treat me like a princess," she says. "You held your breath and the door for me. You already won me over in spite of me. Don't be surprised if I love you for all that you are. I couldn't help it. It's all your fault for being so wonderful." And it's quite sweet, really. And I want to begin by saying that this that they're singing about is not just a load of sentimental romantic nonsense. It isn't. The songs do express a truth. At a human level, it really can work like this. Finding the right person and falling in love with them is a very healing experience for those with pain and sorrow to bear in their lives. As a pastor, I can honestly say it's one of the most satisfying things you can see happen for those in your care. A person whose life is curled up around sadness and anxiety and loneliness and regret and lack of confidence can unfold like a blossoming flower when the right match is made. But equally, we know, things do go wrong with human romance, don't they? What about when a wrong match is made in the first place? Or when a right match is made, but it's done in the wrong way, in a way that spoils things? Or after a long time of hoping and praying, what about when no match is ever made? What about when the miracle of love doesn't ever seem to come your way again? As Christians, we want to hold on to the wonderful truth that these romantic songs do express about what can happen for some of us in this life because of the way God has made us and his kindness in creation. But we also want to say, and there's more than that, much more than that. There is a miracle of love that we can all know through Jesus Christ. We can all be part of the great romance between God and his people. And in our sermon tonight, we're going to try and touch both of those bases: the practical business of human relationships and the eternal business of a relationship with God. And the key issue I'd like us to draw out of this passage is the issue of character, personal character. That's what I want us to see as we read this text. The story of Ruth is a marvellous romance, you see, about two people getting it together against the odds, with all its moments of tension and uncertainty, followed by a happy ending. But the book of Ruth is not the Mills and Boone section of the Bible, even though it's quite short. It's not the gospel according to Barbara Cartland. In certain key respects, it's very different from the kind of picture painted by the superficial aspects of contemporary culture. Let me illustrate that by asking you a simple question. We have read half of the book of Ruth. We have met the two main protagonists, Ruth and Boaz. It is a romance. Let me ask you then, what do they look like? What do they look like? Well, we don't know, do we? It just doesn't say. Ruth could have been a graceful princess or a little dumpling, for all we know. Boaz could have been a strapping hunk or a spindly geek. The Bible just doesn't tell us the kind of thing that we're so interested in these days in our romances. Imagine a modern romance where we don't know what the lovers look like. There are very few modern romances where they aren't strapping and hunky or graceful and elegant. But this romance doesn't look at superficial issues like that. It depends, it turns upon the quality of the character of the people involved. So let's read the next chapter and we'll see how that works out. Chapter 3, verse 1. One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, that's Ruth's mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not try to find a home for you, where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been, a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do." "I'll do whatever you say," Ruth answered. So she went down to the threshing floor and did everything her mother-in-law told her to do. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he said. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it's true that I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until the morning." So she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, "Don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor." He also said, "Bring me the shawl that you're wearing and hold it out." When she did so, he poured into it 6 measures of barley and he put it on her. Then he went back to town. When Ruth came to her mother-in-law, Naomi asked, "How did it go, my daughter?" Then she told her everything Boaz had done for her and added, "He gave me these 6 measures of barley, saying, 'Don't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" Then Naomi said, "Wait, my daughter, until you find out what happens, for the man will not rest until the matter is settled today." And I want to say, when it comes to romance, character is the key. Character was the basis of Naomi's advice, first of all, bold advice she gave. She says, go down to the threshing floor. Remember that it's been harvest. Ruth has been working with Boaz's servants in the fields. And Naomi says in verse 3, "Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know that you're there until he's finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note where he's lying. Then go and lie down with him," she says. Now that's pretty bold advice, isn't it? In case some of us here may possibly be thinking that you're long past being interested in romance, notice that Naomi was just as important in this romance as Ruth and Boaz. Many things about the Western world seem strange to folk from other cultures. And one of these is the way in which young people in our culture tend to form their lifelong relationships. Because typically, they're just expected to get on with it, sink or swim. When they do get advice, it normally is from their peers, who typically are equally as clueless about what it's all about. Of course, in many other cultures, the majority of other cultures, perhaps, then it may go too far the other way. And you sometimes have forced marriages or arranged marriages that are very oppressive in the way they're set up. But the strange way in which youngsters form relationships today, with no reference at all to older generations, is actually really extremely unnatural and unhelpful. And it's not their fault, of course. One thing you can't blame young people for is the world that they grow up in, because that's one thing that young people didn't make. Typically, they've been sold a false set of values and expectations by the world that doesn't know God. And very often, the church hasn't offered a credible alternative as to how you're to live their lives. But I'm sure that as far as God is concerned, he always intended that people would get advice and encouragement from others when it comes to the business of getting married. Especially from those who have a special right or qualification to give a bit of advice and encouragement. Parents or family members or mature people in the community that we live in. And maybe we have a real opportunity here in the church to be rather different from the world. I think it would be great if in the church we didn't just have families that relate well together, but also a wider network of friendships between generations, aunts and uncles, granddads and grandmas in the faith as well. Maybe there'd be two benefits from that. First of all, maybe it would go some way to helping people prevent mistakes in their relationships. An older, wiser third party may well be a bit more hard-headed and objective in assessing the longer-lasting character qualities of someone. Not merely spotting whether someone is a good'un or a bad'un, but also whether two good'uns are the right good'uns for each other in the long run. Because we all know it's very easy to get carried away by the feelings of the moment. You can tell at a glance whether someone is attractive. You can tell after a couple of dates whether they're fun to be with. But you can't tell that easily what their character is actually like. That takes a bit of maturity to assess. And even with that, you still get it wrong. Naomi has had the whole of the harvest to see the quality of Boaz's character. What's more, he's known by reputation as well. And I reckon by now, in the story, she has got him sussed. Boaz is the nearest thing you will find to a new man in the Old Testament. Boaz is decent. Boaz is caring. Boaz is godly. Boaz is responsible. Boaz is in touch with his sensitive side. Boaz is completely hopeless when it comes to taking the initiative with women. Do you know anyone like that? I'm sure they exist. At least that's how I read him. You may read him differently. But I don't think he gives the impression that he's Mr. Self-Confident when it comes to sort of actually, you know, striking up a meaningful conversation with Ruth. Because he's obviously already noticed this young woman in his field. He's had conversations with her. He knows the score, that she's available, that she needs a husband, and that he is very much in line as what they call a kinsman redeemer, with a responsibility to marry and look after widows in the family. He must have thought about it, surely. But what was his problem? Well, we see that in verse 10. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. He's been thinking, oh, she'd not be interested in an old fogey like me. He's actually desperately grateful that she's broken the ice, isn't she? Isn't he? Anyway, that's how I read Boaz. At any rate, Naomi's assessment that he is a good chap, a man of good character, is clearly the right one in this case. As is Naomi's bold advice. Sensing that this is a good match, but also that there's a real danger of nothing happening, she decides a well-placed toe is needed to get this ball rolling. Maybe that too would be the second benefit of a bit of healthy encouragement and advice between generations in the community of the church. Maybe that would help the situation of those in the church who are unhappily single. We know, of course, that some people are called to be single and are very happy to be so. And yet there are others for whom that is a great heartache. And I think there are men and women around in the church who would make excellent wives and husbands, but for whom things just don't seem to work out one way or another. Sometimes it seems just because they don't get over that first awkward hurdle. Sometimes people do need a leg up. I know I certainly did. Now, I know we cringe at the hideously inept attempts at matchmaking that Christians sometimes inflict as a form of torture and humiliation upon each other. Of course, these things can be excruciating at times. But somewhere along the line, there do need to be sensitive ways of giving people a helping hand, giving people a chance to work out whether somebody's the right person for them. What's their character really like? Is there a match? Help over that first hurdle. And it's the culture of the world that says it should be some kind of spontaneous magical accident that says that that's an embarrassing thing to do. Not the wisdom of the Bible, which understands people so much better than our world does. So character was the basis for Naomi's advice. Character was also the basis for Ruth's actions. But they were pretty outrageous actions, weren't they, as well? Verse 7. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the fire under the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. Now, this is what is technically called the direct approach, okay? And this is not something that is recommended and encouraged for everyone, all right? Creeping into bed uninvited is considered pretty risque even today. Then, of course, for a young woman to do this, to approach a man in this way, would have defied all social convention. It was a huge risk she was taking here. He could have awoken, outraged by her effrontery. He could have exposed her and destroyed her reputation at a stroke. Or he might have seized the opportunity with enthusiasm and then cast her aside, and there'd have been nothing she could have done. She was putting herself totally in his power. And the fact that she was doing this was a testimony both to his character, what he was like, and also to her character as well. Because this was an act of huge courage, of great faith and trust. As far as she could judge, as far as Naomi could judge, Boaz was a good man who would be neither overwhelmed by the temptation nor offended by the cheek of it, but this was a great risk she was taking. And she couldn't ever take that risk out of the calculations. So you have to ask, was this a wise, sensible thing for Ruth to have done? Well, it's important that we are wise in our relationships, isn't it? But it's also important that we understand what the Bible's idea of wisdom is. Because wisdom is not always the safe, boring, tame attitude, action, is it? The Bible knows that sometimes to get anywhere, you have to take, quote, risks. You have to be bold. You have to go for it. Wisdom is not about avoiding all the possible risks. Wisdom is about knowing how to choose the right risks to take in life. And that applies in romance as much as anything else. I can relate to this. As a teenager, I employed all kinds of bold and forthright approaches towards the young ladies that I kind of liked. Here is a good one. You might like to try this if you're at school or college. Deliberately miss the bus so that you have to walk past her home. Okay, it's a 7-mile walk, but, you know, commitment. But this is the stroke of genius, okay? So stop outside her house and tie your shoelace. And then, if you're really brave, tie the other one as well. And while you're doing that, you glance up at the house and see if she's there. No? Oh, well, there's always tomorrow, isn't there? Or another one, this is another one I tried, memorize her timetable at school, then spend all afternoon loitering in the corridor you think she might walk down on her way to that next lesson. Then, when she does approach, you can just sort of casually walk past her, and you'll be in her field of view for that crucial 3 or 4 seconds. Now, I have to confess, these are not the most effective methods you can employ. That spell of my life was absolutely excruciating. And in retrospect, I think, what on earth was wrong with me? Why didn't I actually talk to her? Why didn't I even ask her out and get it over with? But it all seemed so fearful. That seemed like such a huge risk. You imagine this girl shuddering with horror inside and then making lame excuses as they run off to share their mortification with their friends. And then there'd be sort of snide comments in class and little notes being passed around and things being written on the blackboard, and it would be utterly humiliating. Girls do that kind of thing, don't they? Also, my teenage instincts told me. My more subtle approaches involved much less risk than actually asking a girl out. Unfortunately, they also involved absolutely no chance of success either. I'm not sure that's the way the Bible encourages us to approach these things. In the Bible, everything is by grace, but we expect nothing to just land on our laps. In so many different areas, from romance and business through to prayer and evangelism, if we attempt nothing, if we risk nothing, we gain nothing. Nothing happens. What does it say? Cast your bread upon the waters, doesn't it? Don't keep it in your pocket. Ruth defied social convention. She risked her integrity, her future, her reputation on the calculation that Boaz was a decent bloke. She went about the business as wisely as she could. So she washed and perfumed and put on her best clothes in verse 3. She picked her moment after the party at the end of a good harvest when he's in good spirits there in verse 7. She picks her words very carefully too. Verse 9, "Who are you?" he asked. "I am your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." She's respectful, yet very direct. And she doesn't appeal to his hormones by being sexy. She appeals to his heart. She appeals to his sense of duty. She appeals to that good character. Because he is a kinsman redeemer, who in the ancient world had the responsibility to protect people in their family, even extended members of the family who were on hard times. She was appealing to him to look after her, to love her. And in this context, that meant to marry her. Nonetheless, all of those wise precautions couldn't remove the risk from it. So she showed character and courage. And Boaz himself could see it too. Verse 10, "The Lord bless you, my daughter. This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after the younger men, whether richer or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I'll do for you all that you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character." So Boaz's answer is based on character as well. And you see the character qualities of both of them in what they do next. Or rather, in what they don't do next. Because if this was the average Hollywood movie, there would be no doubt as to what the next scene there amidst the straw on the threshing floor would be, is there? But not here. And that is not because the Bible is too embarrassed to talk about these things. The Bible is actually extremely explicit when it needs to be. Yes, Ruth goes to bed with Boaz. Yes, Ruth sleeps with him. But that really is all they did on that night. Sleep together. There is no hint of anything more than that. Now, I guess in our modern world, it's in this particular area of life that the test of character, the real test of our characters, will show. And here, of course, I'm addressing those of us who are perhaps that bit younger. When the movie credits have rolled, when you've watched the sun set on the waves and walked back slowly across the sand hand in hand, when you've had your coffee by the firelight and you've shared your souls, the test of your character is, what is the next scene in your movie? What happens next? There are actually very good reasons why sex is right within marriage and wrong outside it. Hollywood believes that sex is something you try out when you're deciding whether you might love someone. And that's not when it's simply a sport, as it were. But in actual fact, the truth of human nature is that it's the way that you sign and seal the promise that you do love someone and will love that person for the rest of your lives. That's what it actually means. That's what the human heart is programmed to expect and believe of it. Even if our culture is all the time trying to tell us that it's something else. And our hearts either break or go hard when we play games with that truth. You end up twisted and torn like Alanis Morissette and all of that lot. You haven't got to be prudish about this whole subject. There's no mistaking the sexual overtones in what Ruth did. But I urge you, if you are not yet married and you are going out with someone, engaged to someone, or someday you might be going out with someone or engaged to someone, then fix your decision now to save sex for when you are actually married. And if it's too late, well, there's always time to start again, isn't there? Because that's what the Lord's like. He's very gracious and forgiving, and he gives us fresh starts if we're sorry. Don't fall for that old lie. If you really loved me, you'd sleep with me. Don't fall for that. Lads have been saying that for centuries. It's not true. Sleeping with someone is easy and proves nothing about how you feel. Waiting until you're married is hard and proves everything about the way you feel. Because you're saying, I love you enough to keep my natural urges under control and to treat you with respect. And that way, you are showing a bit of character, aren't you? And maybe you are single and wondering where a husband or wife will ever come from. Maybe you're thinking that there are no obvious opportunities for you to take initiatives, and you're wondering what to do. Well, there are all kinds of things that you can try doing. You can dress up nice. But of course, in the end, you can't actually change your looks. You can try to be fun. But in the end, you can't actually change your personality. You can go to the right places and do the right things. But in the end, you can't actually make things happen. The best investment that you can make is in your character, in the quality of the person that you are and God has made you. Work on developing the qualities that will give you the best chance in the end, not only of getting married, but getting married to the right sort of person. What's more, if you do that, then you can't actually lose. Because when any of us do that, we're actually gaining something of eternal value as we become more like Christ. So we gain a greater appreciation of the eternity he has in store for us. You can't lose, whether or not, in the end, someone else has got the brains to notice the diamond geezer or great girl that you are. Good character was the basis of the advice and the actions and the answers in this story through which the miracle of love came to Ruth and to Boaz and to Naomi and in different ways healed their worlds. Good character underpins all human relationships. But more than that, it is also the basis for our relationship with God. In the Bible, the theme of romantic love and marriage is a picture of the relationship between God and his people. And the romance between Ruth and Boaz is part of that theme that runs through the Bible. Notice again in verse 9. What does Ruth say? Do I mean verse 9? No, I'm looking at the wrong verse. Here we are. Yes, it's verse 9, chapter 3, that's right. I am your servant, Ruth, she said. Spread the corner of your garment over me, it says. Now in Hebrew, the word corner is the same as the word for wings. It's rather a shame the NIV hasn't used the same word here because you missed something important. Look back at chapter 2, verse 12. What did Boaz say to Ruth earlier? He said, may the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. And that's another one of those coded connections that the author wants us to make. In Boaz's care for Ruth is the reflection of God's care for all of us. And the message is, as Boaz spread his arms of love around this poor foreigner who entrusted herself to him, so God welcomes in anyone who comes to him in the same way. Anyone who has got no home in this world, who is bruised and battered and torn by sin and its consequences, anyone can know God does not turn you away when you put your trust in him. Not if you come in repentance and faith and humility and throw yourself on his mercy. Put yourself completely in his power. And that's why understanding this issue of character is so important. Because in the end, faith is all about trusting God. It's all about correctly reading God's character and realizing, yes, I can throw myself into his arms, if you like. Our confidence as Christians depends upon him being who he says he is and doing what he says he will do. It relies upon him sticking to his word and being consistent with his character. We have to take him at face value. We have to put our eggs in his basket. We have to take a risk on who he is, if you want to put it that way. What does this God do when people crawl under the wings of his love, trusting that he's got space there? Well, there's only in the end only one way to find out for yourself, and that's to trust him and do it. You know as well as I do that there is a growing tide of relationship disaster sweeping through our society. And the social consequences of this are pretty well known. But I suspect that some of the spiritual consequences are not. I worked for a while in a community centre in one of the more deprived areas of Cambridge. Yes, there is such a thing as a deprived area in Cambridge. The majority of people who came along to this centre, for them, relationships were a total disaster zone. All their relationships. They seemed to bring constant pain and hurt. It turned out for most of them that most of the people they'd ever trusted had one way or another let them down. Their mother, their father, their boyfriend, their girlfriend, their partner, just occasionally their husband or wife when they had them. And folk themselves were replicating that behaviour in the way that they themselves treated others. So it would be growing and growing all the time. And when we came along and said to them, have a relationship with God, they would think, a relationship? A relationship is supposed to help? Just another person to let you down? And if they didn't consciously think that, that was the subconscious programming. Because as far as they were concerned, the idea of a father or anything like that was somebody who treated you badly and then walked out, that sort of thing. People were losing faith in faith. They were losing trust in trust. The currency of relationships was being devalued all the time. And it could well be that some of us are in the same boat, afraid or unable to put our trust in God. And you're thinking, maybe he will let me down, and if not, I'm sure I will let him down. Whatever happens, it's bound to end in tears, you think. That's what relationships do. Now I wonder, are we in the church on the loser trying to encourage people in that situation to believe? Certainly we have to work hard to prove in our own consistent relationships with them that we are talking about a reality. But we shouldn't be too despondent. Because the strange thing is, with all the relationship crises that happen, people keep on trying, don't they? It's actually very unusual to find someone who has completely given up on relationships and will always say no when the possibility of a new one comes along. There is an even deeper instinct inside us, you see, even deeper than the hurts that we can accumulate, that is still always trying to find a hand to hold on to find arms to come round us, to find wings where we can take shelter. We cannot bring ourselves to believe that there is no such person in the world who can give us faithful, consistent love. That faithful, consistent person that people are looking for sounds, funnily enough, very much like the God that we Christians believe in, doesn't it? And what does that prove? proves absolutely nothing. Maybe our instincts bear witness to the truth about God. See, says the believer, we all deep down believe in him. Or maybe our theology simply bears witness to our instincts. See, says the skeptic, we all invent gods to meet our needs. The way we feel doesn't prove anything. What proves something is that 2,000 years ago, along came a man, a real man, flesh and blood, testified to in history. People knew him and met him and touched him. He was real, but he was different as well to the rest of us. This man was completely faithful and true. He had no skeletons in his cupboard. He had no inconsistencies in his character. There was a completely perfect one-to-one match between the words he spoke and the emotions he felt, the thoughts he thought, the actions he took, the world he inhabited, and the God who sent him. They all tied up with Jesus Christ. His best friends, his closest family could find nothing wrong with him. His worst enemies could bring no charge against him. And he died for us. And he rose from the dead for us. And that is what proves something. Not the way we feel, but what somebody has actually done. Anyone can say, I love you. And it's anybody's guess what they mean by it. But only Jesus can say with absolute confidence, come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And that's the miracle of love, which can, and in the end, will take away your pain. That's the promise. And I pray that the days of that romance are not over for any of us.